an no-data service. A no-data service exposes an endpoint that implements the OData protocol and thus lets client access data. The OData service has to expose whatever data is behind it using the abstractions of the EDM, the OData data model. And maybe you're thinking, well, wait a minute. If I'm going to have all these different kinds of data, relational data, and SharePoint lists, and maybe some fancy NoSQL stuff, all exposed through one common data model and one access protocol, aren't I going to lose some stuff? Won't I have some limited functionality there compared to what's behind this abstract data model? The answer is yes, you will have limited functionality. Good luck, for example, trying to send the SQL queries across our data. That's not what it does. So yes, a necessary trade-off for this commonality, this consistent data access, is that you lose some functionality, some accessibility of the actual underlying data. Life is full of pain. The trade-off is worth it in many, many cases. Not always, but in many cases. And finally, there are a number of client libraries for OData. Now, since the OData protocol is just HTTP, there's no compelling reason why you need a client library. But it just makes life easier. So there are lots of them available for lots of languages, as we saw a couple slides ago. So here's a picture of those things I just told you about. Over here is my data source with different kinds of data. An OData service has the job of taking that data, whatever it might be, relational tables or lists or something else, and exposing it using the abstractions of the OData data model, which, again, we'll look at in just a few minutes. Client applications then typically use some OData client library to make requests against this service via the OData protocol. Okay, simple. I hate doing sessions right after lunch. I can look in your faces and I can see that all the blood's in your stomach and not in your heads, right? It's the nature of the post-lunch slog, isn't it? It's too bad. All right, well, let's do some scenarios. It's a useful way to get a sense of how and why you might use this technology. Suppose that I've got an application that I built in .NET, in Java, whatever. This app might run in my data center. It might run in the cloud. Doesn't matter. It uses some data. Maybe it's relational, maybe it's something else, doesn't matter. Let's suppose that I want to expose this to a variety of clients. I can do that by implementing an OData service in my app. The OData people will say, you can put an OData head on your app, an OData head. Once I've done that, I can now access that thing from a variety of clients, such as mobile devices. Maybe the goal here is to build an application that lives in the cloud and exposes data about, movies, songs, pick your favorite thing, to mobile devices. That's a reasonable OData scenario. And there really are client libraries for all of those systems, as we discussed earlier. I might also access that data from a browser. Why not? Diverse clients, mobile devices, browsers. Classic scenarios for using OData. And let me just stop here for a second. Maybe you're thinking, well, wait a minute. We live in a world of service orientation, do we not? There was this big thing called service-oriented architecture, which has fallen from favor a little bit, it seems. Somebody told me that what SOA really stood for was suckered once again. Wasn't that great a deal? But people look at this and they say, well, wait a minute. Why do I want OData? I could expose data from that app using services. Why have this generalized OData protocol? Well, here's the answer. The answer is that I certainly could expose data using services. If that were data about movies, for example, I could have a method in operation called getMovieByTitle. I could have one called getMovieByDirector. I could have one called getMovieByGenre, action, romance, whatever. That's what I would do if I exposed that data through services. And this might work, especially for the first set of clients who want to access the data. Then what happens? Well, you know, along comes a new client that says, okay, I like getting movies by title and by director and by genre. But I now want movies by the year they were released. And so what do? You add a new operation to your interface called getMovieByYear. And this client is now happy. Client 3 comes along and says, those are all great interfaces. I like those operations. But I really want getMovieByPopularity. And now you've got to expose this interface, this operation, excuse me. And next thing you know, you're in version hell. If you define operations to expose data, it's like you're punching holes in the curtain to access the data. If you expose data via OData, a general broad approach, it's more like taking down the curtain. And so sometimes you will want to expose data via operations. It's simpler, it's better. But when you're not sure what kinds of requests your clients will make against the data, which I have to say is much of the time, is it not? Oh, data, with its more general approach, might well be a better solution. Another scenario. This time I truly have a cloud application, one built on Windows Azure, using SQL Azure and Windows Azure Tables. Suppose this is an online store. It sells things through a browser. Great. It may be the case that I want to let my business partners access this same data. How do I do that? I could use OData. I could put an OData head on my app and expose it to other applications written using, say, PHP or Java or something else. There are client libraries for all these languages. Turns out that for Windows Azure Tables, which you might know are a very scalable key value store in Windows Azure, the native access protocol actually is OData. So I can access those guys directly if I choose to through OData. And one more scenario. Suppose I'm a data analyst using some BI tools. Suppose I want to get data from SharePoint lists and a custom app, and I want to buy some data from Windows Azure Marketplace Data. For the analysis I'm doing, to choose the location for a new retail outlet, for example, a new store, perhaps I have to draw data from all three of those sources. Now, I want to use various tools to do this, like Excel, for example. But if all of those data sources expose data in different ways, what are the odds that my BI client tool of choice, such as Excel, actually supports all those different options? If instead they all support OData, life gets much simpler. So as I mentioned earlier, SharePoint 2010 and Windows Azure Marketplace natively support OData today. And I can build an OData service on my custom application. I might then use various BI tools from Microsoft and others to access those guys in a common way using OData. So, there are a few scenarios, a few examples that illustrate how and why you might use this technology. Let's look next at the technology itself in just a little more detail. It's a really interesting technical problem, isn't it? To think of a way to translate all of these diverse data sources into some coherent, consistent, but still useful common view. Here's how we do it. The data model. Remember I told you they borrow the data model from Entity Framework. It's the EVM. Well, at base, the EVM is really simple. It's an update of the classic entity relationship model. so there are entities and there are associations between them. An entity might be all sorts of things. It might represent a row in a relational table. It might represent a .NET or Java object, or an item in a SharePoint list. This model says nothing at all about how data is stored physically. It's purely logical, purely abstract. And so associations might be one-to-one, as I show here, between two entities. They might be one-to-many. They might be unidirectional, pointing in only one direction, as shown so far. Or they might be bidirectional. Great. Simple. Using this, I can model all sorts of different kinds of data. But is that the entirety of the EDM? No, it is not. No, it is not. Turns out that, in fact, it looks like this. There are entities, but entities are grouped in these larger things called entity sets. And multiple entity sets are grouped in an entity container. And each entity can contain some number of properties. How might this map to the real world? It doesn't have to be this way, but you could map, for example, an entity set to a relational table, an entity to a row in that table, and each property in that entity to a column value in that row. Similarly, one could map entity sets to a SharePoint list, entity to an item in the list, and so on. It defines a hierarchy of data. One last thing, associations. To model associations, we rely on a certain kind of property called a navigation property that might point to other entities. What's an example of that? A foreign key in a relational database. So it's a simple hierarchy. There's a simple hierarchy. Great. Next problem. I've got a data model. I now need a protocol that lets me issue requests and get responses against data modeled in that way. That, of course, is the role of the OData protocol. As I've said, OData relies on HTTP. And of course, because it's RESTful, it supports the usual things. Post creates a new entity. Get reads from an entity. Put updates an entity. Delete deletes an entity. As you'd expect, the basic verbs in HTTP are used to implement classic CRUD operations. Create, read, update, delete. Turns out there's more than this, though, because The guys who defined OData found that what was in basic RESTful operations wasn't sufficient. And so there actually are a few more things. There are a few more operations like merge, which they invented themselves. They borrow technologies whenever they can, but they also extend them as needed to meet their requirements. The protocol then has two options at the moment for serializing data on the wire. Number one is Atom-Atom-Pub, XML-based. Number two, JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. I got to stop right here for just a minute and ask you another question. Who in this room, before coming in, believed that OData was based on Atom-Atom-Pub? Who believed this? Almost everything that you read about OData says OData is based on Atom-Atom-Pub. This is simply not correct. Just flat out false. The reality is that Atom-Atom-Pub is just one of the serialization options for the OData protocol. It is entirely possible and useful to use OData and never do anything even vaguely related to Atom-Atom-Pub. I really don't understand how that myth that this technology is rooted in Atom-Atom-Pub got going. Because it isn't true. All right. Nonetheless, Atom-Atom-Pub is the most commonly used serialization format for OData today. And so let's start looking at the protocol by looking first at Atom-Atom-Pub. Let me ask one more question. Who in the room is familiar with, you know, Atom-Atom-Pub? Maybe one in five, not too many of you. That's what I would expect. How in the world do you go from a serialization format designed for blogs to a generalized protocol for data access? What? Well, I asked OData's creators why they did this, why they chose this as one of their main formats. And they told me originally they did not. Originally, they defined their own format because they knew what to do. And they got massive pushback from people, customers, who said, no. We know Atom-Atom-Pub. We love Atom-Atom-Pub. Let us just use Atom-Atom-Pub. So, there it is. What OData does is the following. It defines a mapping between the hierarchy of the EVM and the hierarchy of Atom-Atom-Pub. Looks like this. If you recall, in the Entity Data Model, the EDM, entity containers contained entity sets, which contained entities, which contained properties. That was the hierarchy of the EDM. The OData data model. To serialize stuff on the wire in XML, they map this to the Atom-Atom-Pub hierarchy. Entity container maps to service. and it is set maps to collection, feed. Those are in fact the same thing in Atom, Atom, Pub. Collection, feed. Entity maps to entry. And now we're stuck. Because that's as far as Atom, Atom, Pub went, right? But OData needs properties for the actual values. So what did they do? They extended Atom, Atom, Pub, adding properties. Right? Great. As I've said, they borrow technology whenever they can, but they also feel free to extend it as needed to meet their requirements. There's a hierarchy here, as you can see. To make this as clear as possible, perhaps boringly clear, let me do the whole thing. Let me show an example of how you might map from relational data, relational tables, to Atom Pub on the wire. Relational data also has a hierarchy. There's the entire database, which contains tables, each of which contains rows, each of which contains column values. So it's straightforward to map that to the EDM. Entity container is the database. Entity set the table, entity the row, property the column value. As I just showed you, those four things map into Atom, Atom, Pub with the extension of properties at the bottom. So at the other end could come standard XML-based Atom, Atom, Pub documents. Let me address one question that's often raised here. People say, well, wait a minute. If I'm exposing my relational database in this way, that means that somebody using my OData service can infer the structure of my database. Do I want to expose my tables in that precise way? Do I want the outside world to know my table structure? The answer might well be no, I do not. You don't have to do this, however. You are free, for example, to omit columns from this mapping. You are free to do something else, to combine tables, physical tables, into one logical table in the EDM mapping. You're doing this yourself, so you don't have to expose your actual table structure literally. I'm showing this as if you did to keep it simple, but you don't have to do this. Just be aware of it. Suppose, then, that I have a simple little database, a relational database, with two tables, customers and orders. Each one has three columns. Suppose, further, that I've got an OData head on this database, an OData service that exposes this relational data. Here's how it looks for a client to access that data using the Atom, Atom, Pub serialization option. The client does a GET on a URL representing the entire service. In this case, febricam.com/example. What the client gets back with the Adam Pub option is an Adam Pub service document. A service document lists all the services, all the feeds available at this service. In this case, if I assume a simple, obvious mapping, that service document will look something like this. It contains customers and orders, the names of my two tables. They are entity sets in the EDM data model. They are collections or feeds in the Adam Pub data model. Whatever you call them, the client could then issue another GET on one of those things. We know it's a table, entity set, collection feed. This gets hard to talk about because all these data models use different terminology. People will talk about feeds or entity sets or collections, and they all mean the same thing. In this context, it gets confusing. Anyway, excuse me. I do a GET on this thing, and what do I get back? By default, I get back the whole table. I get back an Adam feed document, which looks like this. These are edited. It's a feed document, so it has a feed element. There's the entry, that's defined by Adam. And then look, properties. I told you that was an extension defined by the OData people. That's why it's in that funny XML M namespace. It's not in the Adam namespace. Similarly, look at those properties. They have types. Those types in the custom D namespace here are from the EDM. What you're seeing here is a combination of stuff from Adam Pub, stuff defined by OData, and stuff borrowed from Entity Frameworks EDM. Does this seem messy to you? It always seems messy to me. But when I talk to the creators of this and ask them about this, they said, yeah, we think it's kind of messy too. But it's what people wanted. People wanted the familiar Adam Pub model. And so we had to add this stuff. They began with their own custom XML format in the wire. And they jumped it. All right. There's some more of the feed document. Great. And there are a few more options as well. Actually, there are a lot more. You can do things like ask how many entries there are in a feed with the count option here, the end dollar count. You can ask for a particular entry by its primary key. This returns only the entry in the orders table with the primary key 5630. But don't get too excited here. You can't do joins. This is not SQL. You get a limited set of requests against this limited data model because of the need to have a common approach for accessing all kinds of data. And one more quick thing here. JSON. Anybody who's spent much time with XML can really appreciate JSON. Isn't that true? It's got some real charm, this JSON thing. Here's how things work if I use JSON. That first request, the GET on the root of the service itself, returns not that messy Adam Pub service document, but this relatively straightforward JSON that just says directly, entity sets are customers and orders, which you recall were the two tables in my little example database. I then, as before, do a GET on the orders table, requesting just the column, just the row, whose primary key is 5630. I get back just that. A nice, clean little JSON thing. By the way, for you JSON fans, that D in quotes is something that OData wraps around all of its results. They added that. Just a little more here. Being able to do gets and puts, reads and writes, is useful. But any decent data access protocol must have some notion of queries. We're not going to have full SQL here, obviously. But we can have some simple queries. And so OData defines this query language that you express as options appended to a GET request. Here are some of the things you can do. You can use the top option to get back just the first n entities in your entity set. The first few columns, for example. The first few items in a list in SharePoint. Skip lets you jump down. You can retrieve multiple pages. Speaking of pages, I didn't say this earlier. When I do a GET against a data source, like a table, by default, I get the whole table sent back to me. Well, if you implement the OData service and some client does a GET on a table with 40,000 rows, are you obliged to send back all 40,000 rows in one big chunk? The answer is no, thankfully. OData services have the right to choose any page size they wish and send things back in pages. The client libraries support this to make it easier to do. Here, format. That's how you control whether you want serialization to be in JSON or Adam Pub, which is a default, by the way. There are more. The most interesting are probably these. They use expressions. I can say order by, give an expression. I can say filter. I only want entities that match these properties, this expression. I can select. If you look at this, here's an example. I'm doing a GET on the orders entity set, the orders table. And I want to filter it by order ID. Look at this. That means greater than. I only want the rows in this table, let's say, whose order ID is greater than 3,000 and less than LT 5,000. I can define these kinds of filters. It's a funny syntax. GT, LT, equals, as you might guess, is EQ. The reason they don't use less than or greater than or equal to is because all those things already have meaning in URL syntax. So you can't use them very effectively. So there is this straightforward query set that you can do. And finally, just to review here, Microsoft provides this thing called WCF Data Services Framework. I learned at lunch that here in Russia, you call this VCF. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. Most Americans call it WCF, W for W, because saying WCF takes too long. So the guy I had lunch with said, WCF, what is that? Oh, you mean VCF. I got it. All right. This framework has various parts. The important thing is that there are these things that effectively plug in. There are providers. It ships with an EF provider for relational access. It ships with a reflection provider for .NET. You know, my examples of data here were all persistent data in relational storage or SharePoint. But it could just as well be exposing data from a set of objects in an application. The reflection provider is meant to help do that. And of course, you can build your own too, if you wish. And finally, there are a bunch of client libraries, as we've talked about, for .NET, for Silverlight, for Windows Phone 7, for Java, for PHP, for Ruby, for Android, for iOS. There are boatloads of them. There you have it. OData is an attempt to be a broad access protocol that lets all kinds of clients access all kinds of data. To do that, it defines this general data model. It defines a protocol with a couple of serialization options. And the point, with the support from Microsoft and others, is to address this important problem. Is OData perfect? No. No, it is not. Is OData useful? Absolutely. Perfection is impossible here because we're trying to map among all kinds of different data sources and so on. And yet, in my opinion, the designers did a pretty good job of choosing what to do, exposing a reasonable set of common functionality. My opinion, OData is a useful thing. Thank you. Thank you. I was told to put this up. I guess the feedback is actually on paper, which is interesting. That's nice. And my watch says that we have 2 minutes left. As I'm sure most of you know, or you wouldn't be here, it has become conventional in talking about cloud platforms to distinguish two technology approaches. One of them is called IaaS, Infrastructure as a Service. The other is called PaaS, Platform as a Service. It turns out that IaaS appeared first. IaaS is the choice adopted by Amazon Web Services EC2, Elastic Compute Cloud. AWS with EC2 was the first real cloud platform, released back in 2006. So IaaS appeared first. However, I and most people I know who look at this space believe that PaaS is going to dominate. That PaaS will eventually become the most popular choice. I'll tell you why in a few minutes. Realize though that right now IaaS is actually a lot more popular. And I will discuss why that is true in just a few minutes. But first, some examples of PaaS. As again, most of you probably know, the most relevant example of a PaaS platform here at Microsoft TechEd is Windows Azure, Microsoft's cloud platform. Windows Azure takes an entirely PaaS approach. Windows Azure itself supports compute running applications. For storage, it also treats things as PaaS in SQL Azure, Windows Azure, and so on. If you're wondering what I mean by treats things as PaaS, I will tell you in the next two slides. Bear with me. There's a caching service, a bunch of others, all of which take a PaaS approach. And of course, there are other platforms from other vendors that also offer PaaS. Force.com, Google App Engine. Am I doing this? I'm standing stock still. Why is this happening? These are kind of rude sounds, aren't they? I don't think it's me. All right. Even Amazon Web Services has now added a PaaS option called Elastic Beanstalk. Isn't that a stupid name? It's a cool technology, but it's kind of a dumb name. The truth, though, is that all the good names are taken. So I can't criticize Amazon for the name. All right. So we have IaaS, we have PaaS. What is the difference? There are various ways to think about this. Here's my favorite. Suppose that you are that developer up there, and you are about to deploy a multi-tier application on an IaaS platform, such as Amazon EC2. I'm curious, anybody in the room use Amazon EC2? It's okay, you can still stay. It's all right. Okay? Several of you. Okay, don't be ashamed. It's all right. Yeah. It's a good technology. Here's how that process looks in a conceptual sense. The developer is faced with a library full of VM images. She chooses one for her database system. And then she creates a VM from that image. And probably configures the database. I'm assuming... I'm assuming there is a DBMS in that VM image. Now she chooses another image from the library and creates and configures VMs for her application. Let's assume that her app will be load balanced, so she creates a couple of them, maybe more, from the same image. They have, say, Windows and IIS in them, or perhaps Linux and Apache, whatever. She chooses appropriate images, configures them. Next, she provisions the database, creates the tables, adds her data. Next, she installs the application. And now, since this app's business logic is replicated, she chooses a load balancer to put in front of this. Great. Finally, it's all ready, but she now also needs to do some management of this after the fact. She created this world, and so in some ways, it is her world to control. For example, if one of the VM images she has chosen has a patch applied to it, she can decide when and how to deploy that new patch VM into her world. A little walkthrough of IaaS. What you're really seeing here is that she has a lot of control and a lot of responsibility. I always think of this as embodying the Peter Parker principle from Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. That's IaaS. Here's the same thing with PaaS. In PaaS, it appears as if the platform is already there. It very likely isn't really already there. But to the developer, it seems as though it's already there. And what the developer does here is provisions the database, creates tables, adds data, deploys the app. That's it. That's it. It may be evident why most people looking at this space think that in the long term, PaaS is going to win. There's so much that she doesn't have to do. Things like deploying new patched VM images or configuring the systems. It's all done automatically under the covers. In fact, I would suggest you can think of PaaS as providing three big benefits. Number one, it's faster. There's less work to do to get your environment ready to go. Things can go from idea to availability much more quickly. I've heard that called going from light bulb to launch. I love that phrase. It's great. It's just faster to use. Number two, PaaS is cheaper. There's less to do. You don't need admin. It's a simpler environment. You spend less money on people to administer and manage the environment. Number three, PaaS is less risky. Because the platform does so much more for you, it leaves you with fewer decisions to make. And because you have fewer decisions to make, you have fewer chances to make the wrong decisions. Your odds of not screwing up go up, which is good. So, faster, cheaper, less risky, what's not to like? PaaS is great, right? It's obvious. We're having a PaaS love fest here. But there is this uncomfortable truth I have to share with you once again, which is that despite all these wonderful things, IaaS is more popular than PaaS today. And understand, it's not just a little more popular. It's like on the order of 10 times more popular. It's way more popular. So why is this? Given the obvious benefits of PaaS. Well, no one really knows. I got to pause for a moment here, apparently. Oh, I'm sorry. Too loud, maybe. Okay? Can I leave this off? It's okay? You'll still respect me? Okay. So how come IaaS is so much more popular than PaaS? Here are, I believe, some of the reasons. Number one, PaaS is unfamiliar. Some PaaS platforms, like the one called Force.com from Salesforce, are totally unfamiliar. They have their own languages, their own databases. They're just totally unique. Others, like Windows Azure, are actually a whole lot like Windows, but they're a little different. So developers have to learn at least something to use them effectively. Number two, developers have less control. Oh man. In IaaS, you have huge amounts of control, lots of options. In PaaS, you have to live within the constraints they give you. Now, in many ways, this is a good thing, as I said earlier. But developers, you know, they kind of like being in control. Have you heard this? Here in Russia, do most people drive manual transmission stick shift cars? Do they? Have you heard this? In America, everybody drives automatics. I drive an automatic. I've never owned a stick, right? Everybody except developers, who overwhelmingly choose sticks because they want control. Right? My friend David Platt pointed that out to me a while ago. So that's a huge issue. Developers really want control. In my experience, if you let developers choose platforms, they're biased toward IaaS because of the control. If you let their managers choose platforms, they'll choose PaaS every time because it's faster, cheaper, and less risky. What else? PaaS can raise fears of vendor lock-in. And again, some PaaS platforms, like Force.com from Salesforce, are wholly proprietary. Others, like Windows Azure, are really not very different from the on-premises world. And so depending on what choices you make, you might have more or less lock-in to the cloud. And one more here. Moving existing apps to PaaS can be difficult. We're going to see why that's true for Windows Azure in just a few minutes. But what you're seeing here is a big part of why the title of this talk refers to PaaS being the best choice for new applications. It's because migrating apps to PaaS can be more or less challenging. I gotta tell you though, despite those drawbacks to PaaS, I still believe that PaaS is gonna win eventually. Because all of those are temporary. All of those go away once developers learn to use PaaS platforms, learn to trust PaaS platforms, and thus appreciate that they don't need all that control. The analogy I often think of is when developers moved from assembly language to high-level languages like Fortran and COBOL. No one in this room, not even me, is old enough to remember that. But it was a big deal for a long time because you gave all this control. Nonetheless, the trade-off is worth it, and so I really do believe that PaaS is going to win. This is how Microsoft sees this. I almost never put slides from Microsoft in my talks. I don't work for Microsoft. But I like this one. The argument is that physical machines are expensive to operate and are not very abstract. Virtual machines are one more level of abstraction further out and a bit cheaper to operate. IaaS lets you allocate and use your VMs more effectively. But PaaS pushes this to the farthest abstraction level and the lowest cost. So this chart illustrates why Microsoft has bet so heavily on PaaS. You know, having said that, is Microsoft stupid? Probably not, right? Do you think they know that IaaS is way more popular today than PaaS? How could they not? They have talked periodically about at some point actually supporting IaaS. So we'll see. I'm aware of no announcements. But they could add this to Azure. We'll see. All right. I want to walk through what is good about PaaS, the strengths of PaaS. And to be more concrete about this, I'm going to stop saying PaaS in general and instead focus this down to the Windows Azure platform, the thing that's most relevant to us here at TechEd anyway, being a Microsoft conference. So let me categorize the benefits first and then walk through in a bit more detail what those benefits actually are, what the strengths of PaaS actually are. categories: how PaaS impacts app design, how PaaS impacts app development, testing, deployment, how we work with storage, and finally, admin and management. Let's walk through these. For app design, the biggest and most obvious thing is that you just have less to worry about. One way to express that is, as I do here on the slide, what you're responsible for starts higher in the stack. There's less to worry about. You can ignore all sorts of things, like choosing VM images. You know, on Amazon EC2, there are thousands of VM images to choose from. Thousands. Which is kind of cool. Lots of choice. Except that they're not all from Amazon. Pretty much anybody can post an image up there. And I was talking to Amazon about this a little while ago, and they pointed out to me that they don't make any effort to guarantee the security of those images. So some of those images, when you start them up, they start spitting out spam right away or doing other things. How could Amazon verify their security? How could they do that? It seems impossible to me. So, a PaaS platform like Windows Azure gives you basically a couple of image choices. You have to just like them. You live with them. Also, in Windows Azure, you don't need to worry about designing redundant virtual machines for scalability or failover. That's built into the system. It's built into Windows Azure. And we'll talk more about that in a couple of minutes. Geodistribution, spreading requests across data centers spread around the world. There's this relatively new feature called Traffic Manager that does that in Azure. It's interesting. If you need those things, they're in the platform. For app development, you have less code to write. There's less you actually have to do because the platform does more. For example, Windows Azure monitors your virtual machines and restarts any that fail. I said that badly. It starts new instances of failed VMs. It does not restart where they left off. Integration problems can get smaller. If you have a team here in Moscow, a dev team in Moscow, and a dev team in San Francisco, where I live, you don't have two separate environments you're working in that aren't quite the same all the time. You have this single fixed PaaS platform in Azure that you work on. When you talk to people who are building apps on Azure, it's one of the first things they mention is the value of this locked down common environment. For test, the same things happen. Since there was less code to write, there's also less code to test. And since everybody works on the same lockdown PaaS platform, you don't need to worry about things like having a consistent environment and the test team tracking changes. For deployment, on Windows Azure, deployment is automated. One of the core aspects, one of the core differences between IaaS and PaaS is that in IaaS, you construct the platform, set it up yourself, install all your stuff. In PaaS, you say, platform, here's my app, run my app. Windows Azure also lets you update running apps in place with no downtime. I'll describe how that works in a few minutes. And because the entire platform is PaaS, you can use storage services, you can use caching services, and others with no setup. They're just there for you to use. Speaking of storage, Windows Azure Storage has built-in replication, so you get three copies of everything. Makes backup somewhat less necessary. And you get high availability automatically. In SQL Azure, the cloud-based analog to SQL Server, you automatically have HA databases. It's just built in. And there's no administration of storage. You don't have to administer disk space, worry about logs. These are PaaS storage services. Those things are done for you by the platform itself. Speaking of administration, the last thing here, you don't need admins or developers with admin skills. That stuff is done by the platform automatically. Dev groups test, deploy apps all by themselves. You also don't need to worry about things like OS updates. Windows Azure does that. And I'll talk about how in a few minutes. So, there are a bunch of benefits to the PaaS approach that lets you build applications more rapidly with less work and less long-term cost. To get these benefits, though, you have to do a few things differently. You can't just build apps like ordinary Windows Server apps. And so, for the last half of this session, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the Windows Azure programming model. You're going to see no code, because it's not at the code level as such that things change. It's an architectural discussion. You have to understand conceptually what changes in how you build apps for Azure. Because making these changes is essential to getting the benefits that PaaS promises. So, as I just said, you really can't get the benefits of PaaS without writing apps a bit differently. Microsoft actually tells us that this approach is the future of Windows, both in the cloud and on-premises. They have said multiple times that they plan to make this PaaS model part of the on-premises Windows Server world as well eventually. What that will look like is unclear, at least to me, but they've said this anyway. So, it's interesting. Here's a simple way to think about, and I hope remember, the Windows Azure programming model. You have to follow three rules. Rule number one, a Windows Azure application is always built from one or more roles. Number two, A Windows Azure application always runs two or more instances of every role. Rule number three. A Windows Azure application behaves correctly even when any role instance fails. Those are the three rules. There are at least one way to summarize the Windows Azure programming model. Let's walk through them again, and I will tell you what they really mean in a bit more detail. Rule number one, an Azure app is built from one or more roles. What's a role? Many of you probably know. For those who don't, Windows Azure currently supports three kinds of roles. A web role, which runs iOS. It's meant for web-based code. A worker role, which just runs ordinary Windows Server, apparently. It's not quite true, but it looks like Windows Server. Those two are the main options. You can think of them as being like VM images, like the choices Amazon gives you, except there are only two of them. And they're really similar. The big difference is that one has IIS configured to run, and one doesn't. Great. There's also an option called VM role. VM role lets you submit a VHD, a VHD file, up to Azure and say, Azure, run a VM from this image. Do not be confused. This is not IaaS. In fact, VM roles are not really very useful today, and I will tell you why in about 10 minutes. So, we'll hardly mention them at all from here on out. Let's assume we've got a simple application that's built using two roles, one web role and one worker role. This is a common pattern. The web role, for example, might take requests from users at browsers and pass the work on the worker role to actually perform it. It's a kind of a virtual machine for each one. Here's the thing. I've said these are rules. And they are. If you don't follow them, you will not be happy with how your app works on Azure. But Azure itself doesn't really enforce them. Azure will let you run just one instance of a role. It will warn you, but it will let you do it. It is, in general, a truly bad idea, as you will see shortly. But Azure itself doesn't really enforce this rule. However, to get the SLA, the service level agreement that Azure offers, you must run at least two instances of every role. Unless you do this, you don't get the SLA. All right, rule number three, in some ways the most interesting rule. An Azure application must run correctly even when any role instance fails. Now clearly, if you lose every instance of a single role, if all of your worker role instances die, for example, Your app won't work correctly anymore. It won't. But in this situation, I've lost one web role instance and one worker role instance. And the app must still work correctly. You must build your app to do that. If you don't, you will almost certainly not be happy with how your app runs on Azure. And there are some powerful implications of Rule 3. Among them are these. You better not store data that matters to you in a role instance. Each role instance is a virtual machine. It's a VM with a file system. I can write data to the local VM file system. But I just told you that your app must work correctly if any one of those VMs crashes. And so if one VM holds data that's critical to the app's functioning, and that VM crashes, you have broken rule number 3. Don't do that. You must always put data that's important to your app outside instances in Windows Azure Storage and SQL Azure. You must always do this. Also, if I have, for example, a web role instance that talks to a worker role instance, it should not care which instance it gets. These things must be generic. If you are bound to a certain instance, then you are probably breaking rule number 3. Again, Azure doesn't enforce these rules. It just behaves as if you follow them. And if you don't follow them, you will not be happy with how your app runs. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. This is the suspense in this talk, right? I make you stay here to find out why you won't be happy. All right. I'm going to tell you in a moment why you won't be happy. But to do that, I have to first explain to you this thing called the Fabric Controller, which some of you might know about. In every Windows Azure data center, there is this app running called the Fabric Controller. This app owns all the Azure machines in that data center. It is God in that data center. It is the thing that creates and monitors the role instances on those machines. And so, it starts new instances when you tell it to. Here's a new app, you say. I'd like 3 web roles and 4 worker roles. It will spin up those instances. It also monitors instances. If one fails, it starts a new one. And now here's the really important piece. It also starts new instances whenever it decides to update the system software in one of your VMs or in the physical machine your VM is running on. Remember I told you earlier that in IaaS, it's up to you to figure out when to deploy a new patched OS image. In PaaS, the Fabric Controller does it for you. However, to do this, it has to take down your VMs, right? This is why you must always run at least 2 instances of every role. Because look at this. The Fabric Controller is smart enough to make sure when it creates your web roles and worker roles that it puts them on different machines. It will never put two of your web role instances on the same machine. It will never do that. So whenever it decides, it must update the underlying operating system in, let's say, the VM in web role instance one, this guy. When it has to do that, the fabric controller will just shoot that VM in the head, bang, and shut it down with effectively no warning. And you're thinking, well, wait, it's taking down my app. Well, no, it's not. Because you followed the rules. And your app is built to function correctly even when any role instance fails. Because the fabric controller itself will kill your role instances periodically without warning. Just to be clear, this is a feature, not a bug. Right? This is a good thing. But if you haven't written your app to follow the rules, what happens? If you're running just a single instance of your role, what happens? The answer is the fabric controller shuts it down and your app shuts down. Your users won't like this. Because it can happen anytime. Anytime at all. This is how Azure works. This is how it achieves these nice PaaS benefits. Like being able to keep your app running in the face of failures. But you have to do your part, which means building apps that follow these rules. So, what do you get from this? You get more scalable apps because you can easily increase and decrease the number of instances. More important, probably, you get apps that are more available. If there's a hardware failure, the machine on which an instance is running crashes, the fabric controller notices this and starts a new instance. If there's a software failure, your app crashes, your VM crashes, it notices this, starts a new instance, a new VM. If you roll out a new version of your app, this new version can be deployed with no downtime. You can either deploy all your new instances and then atomically do this thing called a VIP swap where, bam, the new app places the old one in the load balancer. Or you can do rolling updates with these things called update domains where the fabric controller will just take pieces of your app and replace instances one, two, three at a time. In either case, you can deploy a new version of your app without taking down the current running version. A primary goal of the Azure platform is to let you build apps that never go down. They can be updated, can be patched, they never go down. But to do that, you've got to follow the rules. And as we said, you can also do updates of system software with no downtime. So what does this mean when it comes to things like interacting with the operating system? The fabric controller owns the OS in web role and worker role. You can't modify that.
Great. For VM roles, you own the OS, and you must update it. But the underlying OS on the hardware is always owned by the fabric controller, all the time. So, for building new apps on PaaS on Azure, you can follow these rules, you can get the benefits of PaaS. Great. What about moving current apps? People often ask me, well, so how hard is it to move my existing Windows Server app onto Windows Azure? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on how your app is written. So, for example, suppose you've got an ASP application that's already implemented using multiple load balance instances with all state stored externally in SQL Server and no dependence on sticky sessions, no requirement that all requests from a given client go to the same server. It's all totally load balanced. To move that app to Windows Azure and SQL Azure might take you an afternoon. Maybe a whole day if you type slow. Right? It's pretty easy because that app already follows the Azure programming model. But suppose you've got an ASP application with multiple instances, but where each instance has its own person state and it uses sticky sessions. So it assumes a given client makes many requests to the same instance. If your app is like that, it will take some work to move to Windows Azure because Windows Azure has no support for sticky sessions. It wants you to follow its rules, doggone it. Similarly, if you have an application that exposes services using Windows Communication Foundation, which I would call WCF and you would call VCF, it's the same thing. If the services don't maintain the state in themselves, to move that to Azure is straightforward. If the services do maintain state, however, you'll need to do some redesign, almost certainly. And finally, how about this? How about an app with a single instance that runs on a Windows Server box and assumes the box is reliable? This is a very common way to build apps on Windows Server. If I take this application, however, and move it unchanged to Windows Azure, what's going to happen? Well, I'm going to have only a single instance of my application. I have broken rule 2. And if I break rule 2, I necessarily break rule 3 as well. If I have this single instance, the fabric controller will periodically shut it down whenever it wants to, patch the machine it's running on, and restart it. Is that okay? Well, for some apps, maybe it is. But most apps that I work with would not leave their users very happy if they just randomly shut down periodically and restart. So, the question, how easy is it to move a Windows Server app to Windows Azure, requires some understanding of Azure to answer. And the big broad answer is, as I said earlier, it depends. I want to close with a quick look at a little bit broader view of PaaS, because thinking about PaaS in terms of the programming model, compute, is typical, common, straightforward, not too tough. You could also think of PaaS in terms of other things like storage or the other services that you get in the Azure platform. All of them are PaaS. All of them are services just sitting there waiting for you to use. It turns out that trying to apply IaaS and PaaS, these concepts, to other areas than compute gets kind of messy. When you look at real technologies today, it can be a bit hard to categorize them. I would suggest that it's useful to think of a continuum between these two extremes of IaaS and PaaS. Today, for example, on Amazon EC2, which is an IaaS platform, I can run a database server in an EC2 VM. I can run SQL Server, or MySQL, or Oracle, or DB2. But then it's my database server to administer, to control, to back up. That's an IaaS approach to databases. And it's useful sometimes. Amazon also offers this thing called RDS. RDS lets you run MySQL or Oracle in an EC2 VM. But Amazon takes care of a bunch of the management for you. Not totally. There's still a maintenance window during which you can't access the database. It's somewhere in between IaaS and PaaS. Microsoft, we keep on saying here, takes a hardcore PaaS perspective, where things like SQL Azure, Windows Azure Tables and Blobs are totally platform as a service. You do no admin, effectively. There's no maintenance window. There are services that are just always ready for you. There are, of course, trade-offs across this entire continuum. No one choice is always the best choice. But over time, as we keep on saying here, we see, I believe we're going to see, more and more people move toward the PaaS approach. So, I want to be clear about this. I am in no way saying that IaaS is a bad thing. It's not. There are cases where it's really important. We're talking about public clouds here. In private clouds, IaaS is everywhere. If you come back in half an hour, the next session I'm doing is about the Microsoft private cloud. The Microsoft private cloud is totally IaaS. There are plenty of cases where IaaS has real value. In the public cloud, however, I've made this argument, which I believe, that PaaS over time is going to dominate. Which means that especially if you're building a new public cloud application, PaaS is probably your best choice. Why? Faster, cheaper, lower risk. If, or rather when, you get your mind around the notion of less control, fewer options, trade it off for lower cost, faster deployment, less risk, I suspect you'll agree. There you have it. PaaS in one simple hour. Thank you very much. And I'm totally out of time. So for questions, please come talk to me. Thank you. Mic off. Turn my mic off. Four talks I'm doing would draw the biggest audience. And I guess it was going to be this one. But I was totally wrong. The room's only half full. Less than that. I'm surprised because this is a really important subject. And of course, it's also interesting. So, let's start. Two parts to my talk, as so often is the case. First, what in the heck is a private cloud? Believe it or not, there really is a clear answer to that question, which I'm going to give you in a couple of minutes. Once we've walked through that, I will look in more detail at Microsoft's take on the private cloud, which is not exactly the same as everyone else's. So, let's start. What in the world is a private cloud? Before I answer that question, let me answer an even bigger question. What is cloud computing? I've got to start one step back. Here's the world, here's an organization at least, without any cloud computing. Here, there are users who rely on their on-premises data center. They run some applications right on their hardware directly. They run some applications in virtual machines. That's how the world looks in most organizations' data centers today, I would argue. Do you agree? Yes? Great. Cloud computing adds three possible ways to change this picture. Number one, I can run applications in the public cloud. People commonly call this software as a service, SaaS. Number two, public cloud platforms. Number three, private clouds, which in a very real sense are just cloud platform technologies running in your data center. Here's a picture. In a world of cloud computing, people will still run some applications in their own data centers, whether natively on the hardware or in virtual machines. But there are now more options to consider. In particular, we must think about other services offered by service providers, such as a local hoster, such as Microsoft, such as Amazon, and so on, Google. So, my users might use applications that run in the public cloud. What are examples of those? Office 365, Google Apps, Salesforce.com CRM. SaaS applications. My users might also use applications that run on a public cloud platform. Examples of this, Windows Azure, Amazon Web Services, and a bunch more. Notice, generally, not quite always, but generally, public cloud platforms also run their apps in VMs. The third option then is to bring some of this technology into my own data center. And we call those private clouds. It's that third category that's my focus right now. Who was in the talk I just finished on PAS? A few of you. Okay, that talk was about this part of the picture. Now we'll discuss this private cloud. So, what is a private cloud? I'll tell you what it's not. It is not just using VMs. It is not. It is also not just a new name for your current data center. I talk to lots of CIOs these days. Wow. I was in Monterrey, Mexico 2 weeks ago. I gave a keynote at a CIO conference about cloud computing. And at breakfast, I was sitting with a table full of CIOs at the event. And they all began talking about their private clouds. Their private cloud. And when I asked them what they meant, what they all meant was, well, my data center, which in fact had not one hint of private cloud technology in it. It's just become cool to call your data center your private cloud. This is wrong. This is just wrong. Because private cloud really does have a well-defined meaning. Look at this. Today, people widely use virtual machines. They let us have fewer physical servers. They save money in all sorts of ways, primarily through server consolidation. And today, if an IT user, a developer, or somebody else wants a VM, wants a virtual machine, here's what they commonly do. They somehow request this resource, such as a VM, from an administrator. That VM administrator goes through some kind of process to verify that their request is allowed. In a small organization, that VM admin might just decide himself and say, yeah, I think so, or no, not today. In a larger organization, that process, especially for production VMs, might take days, weeks, months. I'm curious, who here works at an organization where it takes more than a week to get a new VM for production? It's okay, it's fine. But if the VM admin decides that it's okay, if step two returns a yes answer, then the VM admin uses some VM management tool to create the VM. Great. Does this process work? Sure. Are most organizations happy with the way it works? In my experience, not so much, especially in larger organizations. If this IT user, for example, works in your company, she's almost certain to believe that step two just takes too darn long. A fundamental goal of private clouds is to make step two go away. Look at this. Here's the same scenario with a private cloud. In this world, here's what happens. Before anybody asks for resources, the VM admin, who's still there, uses these nice VM and cloud management tools to create one or more private clouds. Each cloud is, in essence, a predefined pool of resources. Each cloud has a defined set of users who can access that cloud, quotas, and what those users can do, and a set of services exposed to those users, such as create a new VM. When one of those users wants to create a new VM, she now can do so through a self-service portal, a web browser, that lets her just say, hey, give me a VM. And she gets it. She no longer needs to have a step two, the approval from the VM admin, because he has defined up front a cloud with predefined services, access rights, quotas. What's good about this? Faster, simpler, cheaper deployment of resources, virtual machines, and as we'll see, possibly more. That is a private cloud. That is the basics of a private cloud. So what happens? The users must see a set of predefined services. They can, for example, request a VM that looks like this, or a VM that looks like that, or potentially, they can say not just give me a VM, they can say deploy a new instance of this application. We're going to see the Microsoft Private Cloud is very much focused on supporting not just VMs, but apps as well. The cloud admin defines the services, what users could access which cloud, what they can do. Quotas. So a single user or a single cloud doesn't eat up all data center resources and other stuff. When would you do this? Well, the most common scenario is a development and test group getting VMs on demand. Most vendors, most analysts looking at this space expect that to be the most common scenario for using virtual machines in private clouds. I got to tell you though, I know one vendor who does not think that will be the most common scenario. That vendor, of course, is Microsoft, who supports that, but also really believes that deploying applications is a big part of this story. So, a scenario there is something like this. Suppose you're in a big company, you're in the central IT organization, and you have to provide services, VMs, apps, whatever, to other IT people around your company. Well, that can be a great private cloud scenario, where your users, the IT people, and other divisions, can access this central data center in a self-service, efficient, speedy way. And there's one more private cloud scenario that I see quite a bit, which is CIOs demonstrating innovation. Many CIOs are under substantial pressure to do something about the cloud. And so what do? Well, I told you already, they just renamed their data centers private clouds, which is cheating. If they want to not cheat, they actually start deploying a private cloud. Because they can then say, look, we're doing cloud computing, and get some value out of it. You know, here's the truth. The truth, I think, is that private clouds, in a very real sense, are just the evolution of virtualized data centers. People who have VMs today, not all of them, but many of them, will have private clouds tomorrow. Or at least in a couple of years. Not tomorrow, literally, but at some point. In the cloud platform world, as many of you know, it is common to divide things into these two categories of IaaS and PaaS. IaaS stands for Infrastructure as a Service. Really what you get is virtual machines on demand, VMs on demand. And the big example there is Amazon Web Services EC2, Elastic Compute Cloud. The other approach, PaaS, stands for Platform as a Service. And there, you're running apps on a managed foundation. You're not getting VMs on demand in quite the same way. The main example there, for us at least, is Windows Azure. Private clouds today, including Microsoft's private cloud, are all about IaaS, at least primarily. In a very real sense, private clouds are like putting EC2 in your data center, at least at base, the foundation. And so, people so often ask this question, private cloud or public cloud? Which one do I want? Well, here's my perspective on that. As we've just seen, private clouds can help make inside organizations, internal data centers, more efficient. They can help people like this poor guy who waits more than a month for a VM. Public clouds, however, are the right solution for many kinds of applications. An application, for example, that's very spiky, has big demand peaks, and then drops off. Economically, those can make a great deal of sense to run on public cloud platforms like Azure. So the truth, I think, is that saying public cloud or private cloud is the wrong question. The reality is that both make sense, and so organizations are likely to use both. They address different issues in many ways. And so we should not think of public-private as an either-or decision. You deploy one or the other or both based on the problems you're trying to solve. Turns out, though, that there is this sharp linkage between on-premises private clouds and some kinds of public clouds. Because a service provider, a hoster, for example, can offer a public IaaS service, VMs on demand, using the very same technology that you might run in your own data center for your own private cloud. And that's very interesting, because that means that you can potentially, in your data center, have this thing that lets you request VMs on demand, deploy applications on demand, and you can then partner with a hoster that offers that very same service with your same technology. That's cool. That lets you do things like maybe offload work to the hoster's public cloud when you need more processing power. or maybe rely on this holster for disaster recovery, business continuity. People call these hybrid clouds, where you combine your on-premises cloud with a holster's public cloud using the same IaaS technology. We're going to see. That's a part of the private cloud story that's really important. So, let me end this section with a general illustration of the technologies in private clouds today. Private clouds themselves, of course, depend on hypervisors, the things that make VMs possible. All of this runs on some kind of compute, storage, networking infrastructure, actual hardware. And increasingly, we see that being sold in the form of what's known as converged infrastructure. What that means is you buy these boxes that have all packaged together storage, compute, networking in one cohesive chunk. Now, there's nothing about converged infrastructure that necessarily ties it to private clouds. However, most vendors who sell that stuff sell it in the context of their private cloud. So the marketing story around converged infrastructure is so often tied to private cloud that I chose to include it on this slide. Then, since private clouds still have VMs, you've got to have some VM management tools, like you do today. But those aren't enough. I must also have some cloud management functionality, and then I've got to have some kind of self-service portal for my users. I'm going to show you a couple of examples of private cloud technologies. You will see that they both include all three of those functions, but they group them into products differently. And finally, private cloud offerings today pretty much always have a connection to the public cloud. They have some way to get service providers, hosters, to adopt these very same software and sometimes hardware technologies to build public clouds that offer public IaaS services that can link to on-premises private clouds. If we had more time, I would now walk through private cloud offerings from a bunch of leading vendors, because you could in fact map them into this diagram in a somewhat interesting way. But we don't have enough time for that. So instead, let's just look at the Microsoft private cloud. Here's the Microsoft private cloud, the core Microsoft private cloud technologies mapped against that diagram. Hypervisor. Hyper-V, of course, but also, look at this. ESX, ESXi, that's VMware's hypervisor. Zen Server, that's Citrix's hypervisor. Microsoft's private cloud actually supports hypervisors other than Hyper-V. Whoa. This is remarkable in some ways. This is the new Microsoft. For converged infrastructure, there's this thing they call Hyper-V Cloud Fast Track, where Microsoft partners with various hardware vendors, IBM, HP, Dell, a bunch more, to provide converged infrastructure. For cloud management and VM management, there is System Center Virtual Machine Manager 2012, the next version. It does both of those things. It does both VM and cloud management. For the portal, there's this thing called App Controller 2012, which is in, again, System Center. And there's also something called the Hyper-V Cloud Service Provider Program, which is an attempt to get hosters to adopt these software technologies to offer public IaaS services that can link up with private clouds on premises for hybrid clouds. I told you we haven't got time to look at other vendors here, but I couldn't resist showing you just one other vendor. And that vendor, of course, is VMware. Can I ask, who in the room runs VMware in their organization? It's okay, don't be ashamed. Right? Who doesn't run VMware in the organization? Simpler question. I see three hands. Okay, right. Yes. This is why Microsoft's private cloud solution supports VMware's hypervisor, because they understand that a lot of you are running VMware. Right? And so VMware is also, of course, in this space. Their approach is interesting. They support only their own hypervisor. No surprise, right? No surprise at all. For converged infrastructure, their story revolves around vBlock, a partnership with Cisco and EMC. For VM management, they have vCenter Server. For cloud management and the portal, they have vCloud Director. If you remember, in the Microsoft offering, Virtual Machine Manager 2012 implements both VM management and cloud management, while the portal is an app controller for Microsoft. For VMware, they factor the functionality differently. It's all still there, but they instead group cloud management and the portal together in vCloud Director. Different approaches. VMware also has a program to get hosters to adopt these technologies. So, I have no wish here to do a pros and cons discussion. I just want to show you that this view of private clouds can be applied to lots of different vendors. There really is a consensus today among analysts, among vendors, on what private cloud means. It is not just some undefined, loose marketing term. However, having said that, it's worth pointing out, as I said earlier, that Microsoft's approach to private cloud, while it does support this mainstream perspective, also goes beyond this in some interesting ways. I am going to spend the rest of this session walking through the interesting things you can do with the Microsoft Private Cloud. So, I showed you already these various core technologies of the Microsoft Private Cloud. VMM 2012 for VM and cloud management. App Controller 2012 for the self-service portal. But it turns out there's more. You can, for example, use Service Manager 2012 as part of the private cloud. These are all part of the product suite called System Center 2012. I will show you how this fits in. There's a component called Orchestrator that fits in the story. Operations Manager, the monitoring tool, also fits in this story. So to understand what these guys do in the context of a private cloud, I think the simplest thing to do is to walk through a set of scenarios that illustrate what goes on. So let's do that. Number one, creating a cloud. The admin, in this case, the VMM 2012 admin, uses the VMM console and VMM itself to create the initial cloud. Let's say this cloud is for his company's research group, so it's called Research Cloud. Great. Private clouds let you create VMs on demand. VMs are created from some kind of predefined VM images, VM templates, and they're created by users. So, to make this work, the admin must define users. They're often called self-service users because they're the ones who can ask the cloud directly for things. And he defines quotas, determining which users can do what. Then, since the cloud will provide VMs on demand, he defines, probably, some basic VM images and VM templates. A VM image is like a VHD file. It is a VHD file, for example. That is an image from which a virtual machine can be created. A VM template, as we'll see shortly, refers to a VM image, but adds things, like how many CPUs the VM ought to have. If this were a private cloud that was solely about creating VMs on demand, classic IaaS, we could stop right here. But it's not. As I've said several times, Microsoft's take on the private cloud is also focused on deploying not just VMs, but applications. And so as a result, they create a new role. The role is called application owner. Application owners can use a tool called the Service Template Designer, which I'll show you a little bit later, a couple screenshots of, to create these things called service templates. In the same way that a VM template defines what a VM looks like, a service template defines what a service looks like. And what that most often means is an application. So the app owner creates this service template that defines what an app looks like. From that template, it is possible to deploy complete applications. And I will show you what's in that service template in about four slides. All right, so there we go. We have a cloud, a private cloud. It has VM templates. It has service templates. Great. Let's use it. Suppose our developer comes along and wants to create a virtual machine for her to use. Well, through the portal app controller, she can see which VMs are available to be created. In essence, that means which VM templates are accessible to her. She chooses one. She says, I'd like one of these kinds of VMs. And I want that created in the research cloud. What happens? App controller talks to VMM 2012. VMM 2012 then checks to make sure that this request is allowed. Does this user have the right to create this VM in this cloud? Are both she and the cloud within their quota? If the answers are yes, VMM just creates the VM. Remember that step two that took too long, a long time ago? This is the replacement for that in the Microsoft private cloud. This happens in probably just a few minutes. There is, you will notice, no human approval required. It's all automated. And once again, if Microsoft's goal with the private cloud was to be solely about virtual machines, we could stop right here. But it's not. And so, let's see how this private cloud deals with applications. To make sense of this, though, I need to first talk for a moment about VM templates. Know those guys? That's what she used in this scenario to create a VM. VM templates, as I mentioned earlier, reference a VM image, such as a VHD file. They also define the hardware characteristics of the VM to create, how much memory it should have, the network it's tied to, how many CPUs it has. And they can define some basic configuration of the operating system this VM runs, like the domain it belongs to, its admin password, and so on. VM templates also turn out to be critical for service templates, which is how we create applications. Before we see that, though, one more quick comment about App Controller 2012. It's the self-service portal, remember, for VMM. We've been talking about this. But it turns out that this portal can also be used to work with Windows Azure. You can see things on Azure. You can deploy some services on Azure. Don't be confused, however. What you cannot do is move applications back and forth between those two worlds. The private cloud is IaaS. Azure is PaaS. As those of you know who sat through my previous talk, building apps for Azure requires following a set of rules, which are distinct from the way we most often build apps for Windows Server, for private clouds. So don't be confused here. The fact that App Controller lets me look at both clouds and do some things with both doesn't mean I can move apps back and forth, because I can't. Maybe at some point, not today. And by the way, I appreciate people's enthusiasm in photographing my slides. But two things, you're welcome to, but two things. Number one, the slides will be available with the conference. If you're in a big hurry, come get my card, send me email, send you a PDF. Or number two, this entire talk is derived from a 30-page paper I wrote on private clouds. And these are all in the paper. So, feel free to photograph if you'd like, but to save you the trouble, you don't have to do that. All right, finally, applications. We've finally gotten here. Suppose I have this situation. I have these service templates that describe applications. defined by these service, these application owners in my private cloud. Maybe there's some IT admin person in a business unit of my company that wants to deploy an instance of an application described by a service template. Well, just as in the previous scenario, the developer saw VMs she could create, here he can see in the same portal, App Controller, applications that he can deploy. What he's really seeing are service templates. And so he chooses one. He says, I want to deploy this app in the research cloud. And what happens? As before, the request goes to VMM 2012, which checks to make sure that this request is allowed, that this user has the right to do this, that both he and the cloud are within the quota. If all is well, VMM deploys the app. It's a multi-tier app. Web, logic, data, deploys the whole app, creates the VMs, installs the software, all this stuff. Now think about that. To do that in step five requires a lot of knowledge about the app. Where does it find all that? In the service template for this app. To understand what's happening here, we must look at service templates. If you ask me to list the most important technology in Microsoft's private cloud, my personal opinion, I'd pick service templates. In fact, if you read the paper, it spends a long time on service templates because they are, I would argue, the central thing to understand. Service templates describe applications. Each service template describes a particular application. Not a generic three-tier app, no, but version 3.5 of your inventory application. A precise app. And so their general structure looks like this. Every service template has a name and a release number, a version number. It then has some number of tiers. We're describing apps, remember. Each tier has a VM template that indicates what kind of VM should be created to run this tier. It has an application profile that describes the code that should run in this tier's VM, or VMs. It can have a SQL profile to configure SQL Server. These guys are fairly biased towards SQL Server right now. If you want to use Oracle, you're on your own. You can do it, it's just more work. And there's optionally a VIP template, which configures a virtual IP address for a load balancer. Here's an example. In this service template, I have release 2.3 of my inventory application being described. This application has three tiers. The first tier is described like this. It has a VIP template. If a tier has a VIP template, that means it sits behind a load balancer. That means there can be multiple VMs in this tier by a load balancer. This is the web tier. You'd expect that for a scalable application. The VM template points to a VHD for a Windows Server VM. Great. The application profile points to a web deploy package for the web tier. Tier number two also has a VIP template, which means that this tier can be replicated behind a load balancer. The VM template points to the very same VM image, the same VHD file. Why not? And the application profile points at the code for this app. This code is wrapped in something called a server app V package. You don't have to do this. But if you wrap your code in a server app V package, it's a new feature in VMM 2012, it is possible to, in a straightforward way, update your app while it's running without taking it down. To see more about this, read my paper. It's too complex to discuss right now. And finally, tier number three is the data tier. There's no VIP template. I don't put a load balancer in front of my database. That makes no sense. There is a VM template, which in this case points to a VMDK file. That is a VMware VM image. Why not? The private cloud stuff in SysNet 2012 doesn't care what hypervisor you use. It works the same on Hyper-V, VMware's hypervisor, Zen Server. The app profile points at a SQL Server DAC pack, and there can be a SQL profile to configure a SQL Server instance that has been sysprepped into that VM template. The point here is that service templates create this quite detailed description of an application, enough to let VMM 2012 deploy the whole app, all the tiers. I showed you earlier, they are created with this thing called the Service Template Designer. Here's a screenshot. You can see there's a surface to define your tiers graphically. Then down here, a bunch of parameters to set. You can indicate instances, the minimum, the maximum. You can define upgrade domains, which let you potentially upgrade the app in chunks. You can upgrade the app and never take it down. For those of you in my previous talk, doesn't this sound kind of like PaaS rather than IaaS? In some ways, what they're doing here bleeds into PaaS a little bit. But don't forget, this is Microsoft's private cloud, not the Azure story. Azure is disjoint from this. So this is also kind of cool. Suppose this happens. Suppose I have my application, which was deployed from some service template, and suppose the VMM admin adds a new version, a patched version of the VM image that's being used by, let's say, the VM in the middle tier, the logic tier of my app, right there. There's a new patched OS for that tier. Look what happens. Automatically, VMM will find all service templates that reference this now outdated VM image. It will then go find all the application owners for all those service templates and tell them, hey, you're out of date. Each app owner can decide whether or not to VMM will automatically install the new VM image in the logic tier of the running apps. If the apps are designed to allow this, the update can happen without taking the app down. This is cool. Deploy a patched OS image and have that patch automatically show up in all the running VMs of the apps that use it? That's cool. That's like Azure. That's PaaS-like stuff in what is basically an IaaS technology. It's interesting. It's a nice feature. A few more scenarios here. So far, I've shown you how to create VMs, deploy applications with the portal called App Controller. There's also this thing called Service Manager in VMM 2012. Service Manager can also act as a portal. It gets copies of the VM templates from Virtual Machine Manager, VMM. So our developer might just as well use its portal to request a new VM. The big difference is if she does this, Service Manager kicks off a workflow, code. In fact, it can be custom code that you wrote. That workflow can do whatever you want it to. So suppose, for example, you work in your company, sir, that takes more than a month to get a VM. If you go to those guys and say, we're going to automate this and drop it down to 20 minutes, the admins won't be happy. They will say, I can't trust my users to do this. They will say, I still insist on human approval. Well, you can do that here with the workflow. The workflow might request approval from somebody. Once they get it, they can then kick off this thing called a runbook, which is, in essence, another kind of workflow. In Orchestra 2012, that talks to VMM and creates the actual VM. So I can use Service Manager to do the same thing as before with a bit more control because I have the workflow in the middle. I can also, and here's my last scenario, I can also do this. Suppose my application is happily running along here, being monitored by Operations Manager. Ops Manager puts little demons, little agents, in all those VMs. Suppose that the agent in the leftmost VM, the one that's running the web tier, notices that it's getting a very heavy load. The app is slowing down because the load is too heavy on the web tier. The agent can tell Ops Manager through an alert that it's seeing high web load. Ops Manager can go talk to Service Manager and say, hey, I've got an incident here. We've got a high web load. Service Manager might log that and then start a workflow. That workflow might optionally notify somebody, might not. But what it certainly can do is use Orchestrator and a runbook to talk to VMM and say, VMM, we need another VM, another instance in the web tier over there. VMM, because it has access to the service template, has enough information to actually create that VM over there. So VMM can automatically add a new VM to the application. This whole process can happen with no human intervention if you let it. Where the monitoring system recognizes an app slowing down, passes through the request to make the app better, and VMM starts a new VM. This is a long way from traditional IaaS. This is why I keep on saying the Microsoft Private Cloud supports that kind of IaaS VMs on demand stuff, but their emphasis is very much toward this, toward app support, toward this broader set of things. There you have it. The Microsoft Private Cloud in one simple little hour, I hope, anyway. Private clouds really bring IaaS inside your data center. That's what they're all about. There are some real benefits in doing that. As I keep on saying, the Microsoft Private Cloud emphasizes apps as well as VMs. And overall, I believe what we're seeing here is the next step in the evolution of virtualization. I got to tell you, personally, I expect over the next 2 years, the largest share of money spent on cloud computing, all three aspects from my first diagrams, whether it's cloud apps or cloud platforms or private cloud, the largest share of money, I suspect, will be spent on private cloud. I believe that many, probably most organizations will go in this direction. It's a straightforward evolutionary path from where they are. It provides real benefits. Thank you. All right. And I am once again out of time. So if there are questions, come talk to me, please. Thank you. What is it? Well, Enterprise X, because it's being used by my company only. It only trusts my STS. So this is really simple. I get my token, I submit the token, and the app uses it because it's from Enterprise X. The fact that the app is running in the cloud is irrelevant. It still trusts my same Enterprise X STS. But notice this, that app must have been built using WIF. This is the big rule here. For apps to work in this world and get these beautiful benefits of being consistent no matter where they run, they have to use WIF and be claims-based. So existing apps commonly won't do this. New apps certainly can do this. I also have emphasized this enough. I'm using Microsoft examples here, but this would work if the STS was from IBM or other vendors. There are standards for all these protocols. This is not just a Microsoft thing. This is a cross-vendor thing. But I got to make this a bit more complex, because that's the scenario for an enterprise app that's used just by my organization. What if that app is instead a SaaS application? SaaS means software as a service. It's an app running in the cloud that is used by lots of companies. Lots of different enterprises are using this application. Now what do? Well, you remember back here, the app is configured to trust my enterprise STS. It's possible to configure that SaaS app to trust the STSs of all the enterprises that use it, but it's painful. It's painful. There's a better solution. The better solution is this. To let me access the app and see that that app trusts a Federation provider STS. This is a great example of when Microsoft's cloud-based Federation provider makes sense. Windows, Azure, App Fabric, Access Control, that catchy name. The SaaS app can just trust the Federation provider. It makes life much simpler for the app. Because now, my browser or client goes to access control, which is acting as an ordinary Federation provider. It has been configured to trust my STS. So as always, I go back to it, authenticate myself, get a token, a similar token to the Federation provider, access control. It validates that token and says, okay, this is from an STS I trust, Enterprise X. I will give you what you ask for. I can then give that to the app, which checks as in fact from access control, which it is, and uses the claims. Federation in the cloud. There's one more very cool thing about this I haven't talked about. One more cool thing. Between step four and step five, the Federation provider, STS, gets a token full of claims and issues a token full of claims. Do those two tokens contain the exact same set of claims? The answer is maybe not. Maybe not. An STS in this scenario can do something called claims transformation, where it converts this set into this set with some changes. Why would you do that? Well, think about this. It's entirely possible that this SaaS application is being used by many customers, enterprises around the world. When they issue their own tokens, they might have who knows what claims in them. Someone's name in Chinese characters, someone's name in Latin characters, a user number. I don't show it, but the access control service contains a rules engine that can be configured to do claims transformation. It could rationalize this diversity of claims into one consistent token format, where names are always, let's say, in not Chinese, not Latin, Cyrillic maybe. How's that? The point is that the application will always see the same token format. The diversity of token and claim formats used by different customers, different enterprises, can be hidden. It's all mapped by access control service into a consistent token the app sees. And again, there's that theme. The huge winner of claims-based identity is that life gets simpler for apps. That means life gets simpler for app developers. So that's the big win here. And we're almost done. One more scenario. Suppose that you built an app and you want to accept logins from multiple IDPs. You want to let users log in with their Facebook identity or their Google identity or Windows Live ID or whatever. How do you do that? Well, one answer is you build your app to accept all the tokens those guys issue. You can do that. Except all those different providers, IDPs, have different token formats, and they change. And it's a huge pain to build support into your app to do that. What's an alternative? You should know by now, right? The beauty of federation, right? An intermediary can do translation for you and change that diversity into a consistent token that you see all the time. So, as before, I access the app and see which SDSs it trusts. It trusts only access control, the federation provider. So what do? I choose an identity. It gives me in the web page, for example, a choice. Log in with Facebook, log in with Google, log in with whatever. I choose one, I log in over there, get a token from it, which is probably very simple. The tokens you get from Facebook and Google are really simple. I then submit that token to the access control service. That service understands how to process all of those tokens issued by all of those IDPs. Of course, Microsoft charges you money for that service, but it's incredibly cheap. It's really cheap, but it's out there. What it will do is, as before, validate the token and spit back a standard token that I send to the application, and the app uses the claims. The app now sees a single token format with a single rationalized set of claims, regardless of which IDP I chose to authenticate with. Why is that good? Same as always. It makes the app's life simpler, which makes the app developer's life simpler. And maybe you're thinking, well, wait a minute. Doesn't somebody have to configure access control service with all these things? Yes, someone does. They must define the rules to do transformations and so on. Yes, someone does that. But the rationale here is that that's simpler than making your app support all these diverse formats that change periodically. When they change, Microsoft changes access control. So that's what you're paying for in the service if you use this. There it is. A very quick survey through claims-based identity with a bunch of scenarios to illustrate how you might use this. You know, this whole idea of having identity in this way has been around for quite a while, on the order of a few years. It is not yet totally mainstream. It's getting there, but it's not yet totally mainstream. Why? It just takes time to change how apps have identity. It just takes time. And so, all the pieces required to do this on Windows are here. ADFS 2.0, WIF, Access Control Service, they're all here. And so I know that Microsoft strongly encourages folks to do this in this world. And I have to say, personally, makes sense to me. Getting your app out of the business of authenticating users is a good thing. Letting your app do identity in a consistent way, whether it's running in your domain, across the internet, in somebody else's domain, in the cloud, these are also good things. So to me, this technology is full of positive things, full of wins. And remarkably, I have finished with 5 whole minutes left. So, what do you think? Should we do questions or should we all just go home 5 minutes early? Questions, yes. I'll repeat the question. Do you mean, is there only one copy of access control in the whole world?
Yes.
No, there's not. There's not.
Yes,
it runs in different data centers around the world. Yes, there's not just one copy. Yeah, that'd be bad. Yes.
How admins can control user access to target application?
User access to
target application.
Oh, to the target application.
Yes. Yeah. Currently, if my application is being invaded, admin can select user from a list from Active Directory. And I don't understand how this admin can select user from some list.
The question is, how can an admin control which users can access which application? Right? It turns out that I didn't explain this very clearly, I'm afraid. When a client goes to the STS in ADFS and asks for a token, the client is asking for a token for a certain application, not just any old random token. It wants a token for that app. And so potentially there, you can block that. You can say, this user can't access that app. So there are ways to do some of these things. So there's still some control. It's a little bit individualized. But there are ways to do this because you are asking for a token for a certain app from a certain user. Okay? Yes? Oh, can one user use a token from somebody else? The answer is no, because there are things I didn't show you here in the token that prevent that from happening. So you can't really do that, which is good. That'd be a bad thing. You could do replay attacks. You could steal it and use it again. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for presentation. My question is you described how to send access control, information about access control, but there are relationships between users in Facebook, in Active Directory, there are groups. So how do you send information about relationship between users? For example, you can log in and I can log in. You're from Microsoft, I am from HP. You should have access to information of your company, and I should have access to information of my company. But application in cloud doesn't have information. So in any way, I need to maintain user database again in this cloud application and say, okay, there are users, okay, but there are relationships and so on. So.
Yeah. This is a good question. I did not mean to suggest that applications won't necessarily need to maintain per user data anymore. So the answer to your question is there are a couple possibilities. One is you could define claims to do all this. You could have claims defined that specify that when I get a token, there's a claim that says I'm from my company. When you get one, claim that says you're from your company. And the app could then check those in some way to make an access control decision.
But Federation Manager removes all of these.
Not necessarily. No, Access Control Service could pass those through. It depends on whether or not you do claims transformation. You don't have to check those things out. You can pass the same claims right through if you want to. It need not change them. Alternatively, you certainly can have the application maintain per user data like it has before, just not login data probably. Applications may still find it necessary to maintain a database about users for various reasons. So you can do this stuff. It doesn't make things quite as straightforward. You know, this is a general comment. If you sit through any of my talks, the world can look pretty simple sometimes. I should warn you, the world is always more complex than my talks make it seem to be. Because my goal is to paint the big picture, the straight through path, give you the big painting of what's going on. My goal is not to oversimplify. My goal is to simplify enough to help you understand things to get going with them. And so this is an example of a case where I've just left out stuff that you can do that can make the world more complex. And with that, I think my 5 minutes are up. If there are more questions, please come talk to me. In any case, it's been great to be here in Moscow again. Thank you very much.